Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. This is my final Bible study to have while I'm teaching school. So next time you see me, I will be retired from the public school and no longer have an excuse for being late, not having anything ready. But I've been doing this for 22 years, teaching middle school and then teaching Bible study in the evening. So on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday for a long time, and then sometimes even on Thursday. So it's exciting for me because hopefully I'll be able to spend more time studying and be more prepared. But anyway, thank you for being here. Thank you for making the long journey. Hopefully the hard years are over and we got the easy years ahead coming. We are back in Ezra chapter 4. We left off here. Don't even know when it was, but we left because we had to go to Haggai and Zechariah, the books, because right here in 520, Haggai and Zechariah begin to prophesy. And it is right here that they get the people stirred up and get ready for them to build the temple. They came back in 539 from Babylonian exile with Cyrus. So we've got Cyrus right here. Cyrus making a decree. We even have the Cyrus cylinder in the British Museum where he's proclaiming the actual sending the people back. Not just the Jews, but everyone, just all the people that have been deported by the Assyrians are being sent back to their homeland. So we're going to have here on our chart up here, we've got the Babylonians, but before the Babylonians, remember, were the Assyrians that were defeated by Nebuchadnezzar. The Assyrians had come in, and we'll talk about it tonight again, in 722 B.C., here's our numbers, 722 B.C., and destroyed northern Israel, northern 10 tribes, and their practice with people like Esarhaddon and Sennacherib, or Sargon, was to take the people and disperse them, not necessarily take them captive, but to take them and displace them, take them out of Israel and put them somewhere else in another province that Assyria had captured or conquered, and then take some of those people in those areas and bring them into northern Israel so that the people were mixed. They figured the best way was divide and conquer. If you can take a national people that's got the same religion, the same language, the same culture, the same custom, they will hold together and they'll oppose an emperor coming in. Now, here's a lesson for the people, if you want a modern application. If they can stay together, they will resist. But if you can break them apart, take half the people and move them over here, bring another group of people in that have got different gods, different language, different culture, bring them in, and then have them begin to intermarry and have their religions kind of melt together, their cultures kind of melt together, they'll lose their national identity, and they're going to form a new identity under the emperor, the empire, and your problem is solved. They have nothing to rebel against because this is who they are. And that may be taking place in our own culture as there's an elite somewhere that's trying to break everything apart. Ultimately, the middle target is Jesus, but they're chipping things away, and pretty soon you're not be able to resist anything because you have nothing's common, nothing's unique. Now, Cyrus then came in after Babylon defeated the Persians. Cyrus came in and says, okay, all you people, you can go back to your homelands. Now, the Jews were built for this. The Jewish nation on Mount Sinai was given the law of Moses. It gave them not just a religious order of, you know, of confessing their sins and identifying sin and having a sacrificial system. It gave them a dietary law. It gave them a clothing law. It gave them a rules and regulations to live by. Some of them, now keep thinking, and you got to make a comparison think if this is accurate. Some of them were moral, like eternally moral. They're God's standard because he's the creator. This is the way the Creator is going to do things. So you've got the Ten Commandments. These are, in a sense, absolute moral codes. And there's others within the Law of Moses. But also there was within there a cultural code. because all the pagan nations are eating this, you're not going to eat this. Why? Because you're going to be different from these people. I'm going to build a culture. This is what they wear. This is the way they cut their hair. You're not going to do that. What's that got to do with morality? Nothing. It's got everything with to do with you being a separate people. The word is holy. Now, we have in our minds the word holy. You know, angels start to sing and everyone gets a halo because you're holy, you're righteous, you're good. Holy has that connotation, but holy means separate, separated. It can mean these people have long hair, you have short hair. You're holy, you're set apart. That doesn't mean it's a moral thing, it just means you're different. You can't mix with them. You can't eat that, you're set apart. You're a holy people. Now again, it has a moral connotation, but it can also have just a cultural separation. And God designed the Jews with the law of Moses to be moral, absolutely righteous like he is holy, but also set apart for him. So your customs, your festivals did not follow the pagan calendar. Your festivals followed what God's work in your culture was about. From the Passover to all the events that took place, he gave them a culture, a holy culture, not morally necessarily, but a holy separate culture. This is different, and it's not going to fit into anybody else's culture. Now live this way and be separate. And so when those that did follow it, of course, they rebelled against it, and that's why they end up having their temple destroyed and being dispersed by the Assyrians. Nebuchadnezzar comes in, deports them, takes them captive. But while they're in captivity, they had the word, they had the law, they had their culture that they held to. Now, not everyone held to it. Some of them, for example, someone coming up here very soon, Esther, where's Esther? Esther right here is going to be someone after the people have come back, after the temple is built. Esther is going to still be in Babylon, and Esther's going to rise out of the harem and become the queen of the Persian Empire. She's going to marry Xerxes, the king, and his name is coming up here. And so there were those, and they were still, in a sense, separate, but they were a little more combined and melted, blended in. And so then you're going to have a full spectrum of those that are Ezra. You're going to find out it's going to disturb you. Reading through the rest of Ezra, there's going to be places that's going to disturb you because he is very much about being separate, very much about being a Jew and being holy. There's some time things in Ezra. He's going to find out that some of the people that have come back from exile to rebuild the temple, some of them, even the priests, have married some of the Gentile women. Some of the Samaritans we're going to read about tonight, they've actually crossed over because it was working. You put these people together, they're going to start to intermarry. Now, these people have come back from Babylon to rebuild the temple and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. But the Samaritans that the Assyrians had brought in had in the north had already intermarried, and so they are part Jewish, part Gentile. Well, they began to interact with these people that had returned that were Jewish, and some of the priests had actually married into those lines. When Ezra finds out about it, you're going to read it, it's going to be like, it's not James Dobson, focus on the family. It's exactly the opposite. It's like, you married a foreign woman, you've got foreign kids, send them away. You're a Jew. You're a priest. You're here. Get rid of your wife. Get rid of the family. It's like James Dobson would be having a fit. It's like, what about marriage and divorce? What about? It's like, no, we're about being a separate people set apart by God. And that's coming up in here. Nonetheless, I ramble on and on. Because they had a separate holy culture, while they're in Babylonian captivity, they preserved it. So when it came time to go back, some people, some of the cultures, didn't go anywhere. They'd lost their identity. It's like we're Babylonians, or we're here in the Middle East, or in Mesopotamia, and they never came back. The Jews, because of guys like Jeremiah, Ezekiel, they had maintained their identity. So when Cyrus says go back, he got out their temple, the golden goblets from the temple, gave them to the people. And they went back and they knew where they're going. They knew their history and they could rebuild. They came back. Now, some people, the liberals, the minimalists in of Scripture, they'll say it was during this time when they came back, they had no history, they had no identity, and it was during this time people like Ezra created their history. They created the concept of Moses and the ideal of Abraham and the covenant, and they says, oh, you've got this covenant with this great God, and they created all these documents. When you read commentaries, you can smell it right away. They start talking about the tradition or what they were taught in Babylon, and they'll date all these letters to sometime in here. Post-exile is when the Old Testament was written. This became very popular in the 1880s in America, which led to the deterioration of our seminaries, which then went out into the churches and plagued the churches. And basically in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, the churches began to go very liberal because it was all just a legend, just a story made up by these people. And it really doesn't make sense because these people came out, if they came out of captivity, they would have been Mesopotamian, they would have been Babylonian. But they came out on fire, they knew who they were. And then some of the challenges to that, they began to have practices or reinstitute practices like the priesthood, where they take certain amounts of their money, their produce, and just give it to the priest. Circumcision. There's a generation somewhere there was the original circumcision generation. And that would have been these people coming back out of captivity. Oh, we've got a great God. Give all your money to the priest. Listen to them. Oh, also, all the men need to be circumcised. It's like, okay. It doesn't. There had to be some event. And the Passover. We're going to celebrate the Passover. What's the Passover? Oh, that's when we were delivered from Egypt. We're a great people. How great were we? Oh, you were slaves. You were slaves in Egypt. And God set you. It's like, that's not a great. If you're going to make up a story, we weren't like descendants of slaves. We're like descendants of gods or something. I mean, to go like with the Greeks, they're all descendants of the gods. The Jews, descendants of slaves. So again, it's a really weak story, which means it has the historical backing. Anyway, they came out, came back. Cyrus sent them back to rebuild the temple. And send them back. They arrived in 536. They began making the temple, rebuilding the temple by 536. The temple, the foundation is set. Again, they put the altar down first, and they established the altar, so they began the sacrifices. Now they begin building the temple, and that's kind of where we ended up months ago when we were in here before we had to go to read what takes place in 520, because right here there's going to be opposition. Once they start building the temple, there's going to be opposition from the people. Because those people that were in the land, it smells a lot like the Palestinians and the Israelites today, or the Jews, the Palestinians and the Jews. You've got the Samaritans that are in the land, then all of a sudden in 538, the Jews show up to their homeland and say, well, we're home again. We've been in captivity. This is our land. And it's like, wait a minute. Now, fortunately, they had an official legal document from Cyrus. They're coming back. This is their land, and they've got government financing to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Well, this is okay. This is ready to go. But the people in the land are kind of like, wait a minute. We've already got something going here. We've been here, and you're going to hear tonight, we've been here since the days of Esarhaddon, or the Assyrian kings that sent us into captivity. We've been here ever since, which is going to be pushing 200 years that they've been there. And then the Jews are dispersed, and they just kind of moved in and occupied their territory. So this rebuilding of the temple is going to cause opposition. One is going to be the people of the land. They're going to be called the people of the land. They're going to be called the enemies. Are going to come and say, great, we'll join you. This will be, we can fit right into this. There's going to be two problems with that. One is spiritual. The people of the land of Israel of that time, which we could call them the Samaritans, they're half Jewish, half Gentile. They're mixed together, not just genetically, but culturally and religiously. They worship Yahweh. Remember, we went through the prophets like Amos and Micah, and the people that were being judged by God through the prophets and then dispersed by the Assyrians, they worshiped Yahweh. They worshiped Yahweh. But they didn't use the Jerusalem temple. They used their own shrines in Bethel or Dan. And they didn't use the Levitical priesthood because they had their own priest to worship Yahweh in their own temples for Yahweh. And they had their own rituals, and they'd combined them with Baal rituals, Baal practices, and all the foreign gods that they'd absorbed. So when they said Yahweh, they were not talking in the same sense Yahweh was worshipped in Jerusalem, if you understand what I'm saying. Now, again, there's application there. We've got Christians in America, and they all name Jesus. But now, where's your definition of Jesus come from? In Jerusalem, at the temple, it was supposed to come from the law and from the rituals that were very stringent so that you could not deviate, you could stay pure, and you could understand that Yahweh could reveal himself because he was telling you who he was. In northern Israel, they took the name Yahweh. We don't need that temple. We'll build our own temple. And they designed it. They built it. And we need a priesthood. We're not going to use a Levitical priesthood. They stayed there. We'll have our own priesthood and our sacrifices and our rituals. A lot of it sounded the same. Maybe they had some of the similar holidays. But it was overrun with paganism. And so when they worshiped Yahweh, the prophets came out of Judea or Judah, and would come up and they would condemn them, even from their own people. They would be condemned by God. You're not doing it right. It's like, well, we worship Yahweh. So you can see people today, everybody that throws around the name Jesus, well, I follow Jesus. It's like, okay, what Jesus? I mean, your own Jesus in your own mind, your own Jesus in your own culture, or the Jesus of the text of Scripture? And so there's a, you know, and we're all somewhere in there. I mean, you know, because we live in this culture, we're influenced by this culture, we're trying to renew our minds like this. And so when they come and they say, we want to help you build the temple, you can't, for one reason, spiritually, you're not pure. And it's not like a derogatory thing. It's like you have no idea who Yahweh is. You can't bring your Yahweh worship. Yeah, we'll do the same thing. In fact, we used to come down in Jerusalem and offer sacrifices while you were gone. It's like, well, I'm sure you did it wrong. You can't join us. The other reason is Cyrus gave the exiles that were returning, he gave them legal precedence, or he gave them the legal right to build the temple. He didn't say, you go back and join with the cultures that are there and rebuild the temple. They are supposed to do it themselves politically, and they're supposed to do it themselves spiritually, are two reasons why they have to do this. And so that's kind of where we're at. If you look on the notes, very quickly before we begin reading, here's the notes. The top of page one, there's your timelines. You've got Zerubbabel coming back in 537. And begins to rebuild the temple. It's done in 516. That's just a simple chart. They return in 537. Cyrus makes his decree in 539. By 516, the temple is done. Now, what we've skipped here in that little diagram at the top, you skip Zechariah and Haggai coming to influence the people. We also skip the fact that in 536, the opposition was so great that the people just gave up. And there was opposition. The opposition first came when they said no. The opposition came in the form of verbal and then tactical as far as causing trouble. Imagine trying to get something done in the government, but the government doesn't want to do it. They're going to, what they call lately, slow walk it. It's like, okay, they're filing charges, but they slow walk the thing until finally, by the time you even forgot what it was. Everybody's, the media's moved on. The people have moved on. The person you're bringing charge against now is probably dead. It's like, and that's what they did. They were trying to build the temple. They interfered with the supply line. They interfered with all the communication. And then, we're going to see, they began to write letters because this is 536. Watch this come down. Cyrus, by 530, Cyrus has died, and Cambyses becomes the leader. His son replaces him. Cambyses suddenly disappears in 522. He has a campaign. Cyrus was planning on attacking Egypt. Cambyses invades Egypt in 534. Cyrus dies in battle. Cambyses, while he's coming back from Egypt, and he is successful. We talked about that when Cambyses was successful against the Egyptians. In 522, Cambyses, somewhere around Mount Carmel, on his way back up the coastal plain, disappears from history. And no one really knows what happened. I mean, he dies. He's assassinated. He falls into the Mediterranean Sea. Something happened, and he is just gone. And there is now a gap. The emperor is gone. And so there's two or three people that take role in that. That's where this gap is right here between 522 and 521. One is Pseudo-Smerdis. Cambyses had a brother that tried to overthrow him called Smerdis, and Smerdis was then executed and got rid of. But then after Cambyses disappears, someone, probably one of the magi, the magi were not just court magicians, they were ones that held the power. You can see how Daniel held power and they would influence the king. One of them, and Nebuchadnezzar was very suspicious of the wise men, the magi. He just says, hey, he's Smerdis. You know, they didn't have photographs and everybody couldn't tell. He says he's Smerdis, that he escaped the execution. And he leads a revolt back in Persia while the military is still out and about. And finally, Darius, one of Cambyses' generals, by 521, puts down the revolt. And at that time, again, imagine the Persian Empire. Look at the Persian Empire, say right there. It's all under the control of Cyrus and then Cambyses, who then advances way down to Thebes with Egypt. Then somewhere around, like you can see right there where Megiddo's at, he disappears. And now that whole empire has no emperor. And so everybody's now talking revolt. It's like we can throw them off. And then they're fighting within their own ranks. And that's when Darius arrives in 521, puts it down, and has to now establish with no doubt that he is in charge. There's no reason to lead a revolt. And so by 520, things are back under control. Darius does a great job of getting things. That's why he's called Darius the Great. Does a great job of getting things back organized. He was one of Cambyses' generals. And that's right there. Haggai and Zechariah move in and fill the gap, because once things become stabilized, it's a chance for them to get back on track, and they're going to then appeal to this original decree. Cyrus said we could, but since Cyrus is dead, Cambyses has come, there's been a revolt. No one remembered. I mean, just think how fast we forget, well, you know, the decrees or the laws or the rights or the court decisions, and people start just doing things. And in this case, they're in a distant land, per se, under opposition from the Samaritans, and they can't do anything. And so the people, with that opposition and the confusion in the empire, the people are just like, it's too hard. Now here's another lesson for us. When it's too chaotic, it's too hard, there's opposition, people don't want us to do it, and then you're gonna start saying things like you're gonna see the prophet saying, is it time to build the Lord's house? You say, it's not time yet, it's not time, but it's time to panel your own houses. It's like, we don't have any money, it's too hard. We just can't do the Lord's work. Meanwhile, you're taking care of your own self. And so human nature, they do the same thing that we would do. The opposition gave them an excuse. Now again, you've got to read the situation. Sometimes opposition means don't go this way, you're going the wrong way, God's not with you. Sometimes opposition means you're going the right way, doing the right thing, you're going to have to man up and work through it and trust God and just keep going. These people at this time, again, coming out of captivity, they faced opposition. Who are we? What can we do? God can't expect us to do something. Well, in 520, Haggai and Zechariah show up and says, yeah, he does. It's time. And they gave him several reasons. We'll talk about that, and we already have spent several weeks going through these. And so by 518, they're back working on the temple. And 515, 516, the temple is done. And so you can see right there, that's 516. All that takes place between 537 and 516. Ezra says nothing about all those details. He simply says that at the beginning of chapter 5, he mentions that God raises up Zechariah and Haggai to encourage the people, and Zerubbabel to get back on the job. So all that stuff has taken place. Again, crazy stuff. You talk about crazy times in an empire, they're losing control of their empire while Haggai and Zechariah are saying, get this temple built. And Darius stabilizes it. He's not going to go away. In the year 458, we're going to move down here, 458, Ezra right here is going to be coming back into the land himself. Oh, excuse me. Ezra returns and the law is taught. Here, let me do this. Temple. Ezra, 458 right here at the bottom. Ezra's going to be back. 485 is going to be what we're looking at tonight. Esther takes place during Xerxes' reign. And then 458 right here, during Artaxerxes' time, which is the one Nehemiah is going to be talking with, Ezra leaves and comes back to Jerusalem. So he's writing about many of these things, but Ezra's not going to show up in Jerusalem until 458. And Artaxerxes is the one that's going to be appealed to tonight in our story. He's going to be appealed to, and he's going to say, yeah, you've got to stop what you're building. We'll talk about that. But Nehemiah is going to show up and change his mind, and Artaxerxes is going to say, you can build the walls. So that's all kind of seen on that chart. And then, of course, the other picture on the bottom of page one is what I've got right here on the wall. Turn the page. There's a big picture of what I've got on the wall. And then here is a detail of some highlights year by year of what's taking place, 537. We're not going to go through all of that. But that is, you can see the events that take place. Say, like on page 3 in the year 525, Cambyses totally defeats Egypt in the eastern delta of the Nile and captures Memphis. Cambyses decides to capture Oasis of Ammon. I made a mistake. He didn't go all the way down to Thebes. That was another king. He goes all the way out, moving west through the desert, and 50,000 of his troops perish in the desert. And in the last few years, they have found, the wind blew the sand, and they found a ton of bones. They think that they found his army that was buried in the sand. But then 522, you can see Gamata, or a pseudo-Smyrnus, claims the throne back in Babylon. Cambyses disappears on near Mount Carmel. 521, Darius Hystaspes, and he takes over. And then 520, there's your prophets. And then the temple is done. And now, we're going to go to Ezra chapter 4. I'm reading in the NIV. You can read in your Bibles. I'm going to read off the notes, and you can follow that, because I've got it kind of broken down there. Ezra, point one on the bottom of page 3, Ezra does not record the events between 536 and 515. He doesn't record all these details. The prophets Haggai and Zechariah focus on that the people had to return to God. Ezra is going to be focused on the external pressure. So we just got done reading Haggai and Zechariah, and they're talking to the people and about, you know, if you have their sinful attitude, the things they need to correct. Ezra is going to just mention their names, but then is going to talk about the opposition the people were facing. So he's talking about the external pressure. The prophets are talking about the internal sin and the change that needed to be made. And so chapter 4, verse 1, we begin on page 4, and I've got some things written down. And this, I've kind of set the basis for it, so some of this will make sense. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel. So the enemies of Judah and Benjamin, those are the people that have returned. The enemies are the people of the land. And I talked about all this. This is interesting. Point one, the enemies, also the people around them. I talk about the dispersion. But do notice I've got a paragraph there from 2 Kings 17. It's point B. Assyria, all besides deporting the Jews out, they also, like I said, imported Gentiles in. The Gentiles from conquered nations into northern Israel to intermarry and weaken the national identity. And now 2 Kings 17, I'm going to read a couple verses out of that. It's written right there, describes that. Now 2 Kings, again, if you understand this, 2 Kings, the ending of 2 Kings and the ending of 2 Chronicles may have been put together by this time period, Ezra writing history back. Now understand there's a difference between saying Ezra and the people after the exile created all of Israelite history. There's another thing that they've got records coming all the way down. They go into captivity, and then as they see it develop, they finish the book of 2 Kings and they finish the book of 2 Chronicles. It's kind of like Moses wrote the first five books, but who writes the closing of Deuteronomy? I mean, Moses is dead. I mean, so it's like, well, he wrote it ahead of time. Okay, you can run there with your King James Bible if you want to, but it's possible that someone edited it and put an ending on the book of Deuteronomy, if that makes sense. It's like it's got to be that way, if you understand. And so this, when you read this caption right here, this is probably not necessarily written during the event, but closing down the book. And here it is, 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 24 through 25. Until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had spoken by all his servants the prophets, so Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. Now when it says until this day, that would mean even into this time period, who returned? Benjamin and Judah returned. The people that were exiled by the Assyrians, they never came back. The Babylonian captives of Nebuchadnezzar, they came back out of Babylon. But if you're dispersed out of the northern 10 tribes, that's why they refer to the lost 10 tribes. And again, that's a little confusing because some of those 10 tribes before the deportation, and we talked about it during Hezekiah's time, say 720, 710, even before that, 730, they would have fled south into Judah. And every tribe probably had people in Judah or in Jerusalem, and that's why the walls were expanded. And that's why when they went into captivity out of Judah, there's people from every tribe that went into captivity because not everybody stayed and got overrun by the Assyrians. A lot of them fled down to Hezekiah's Jerusalem. But those that stayed and were exiled, they to this day, the writing of this, and I would say even until our day, are still dispersed. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. And the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria, or northern Israel, instead of the people of Israel. So he took the people out of their homes and brought people in and says, here, move into their homes, because they didn't burn every house. It'd be like the people of West Des Moines being packed up and taken out, and someone from another country being flown in and says, there, go find a house. Well, it's kind of like the border right now. But anyway, Samaria instead of the people of Israel, and they took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities. And so when you're flying people from Texas up to Martha's Vineyard or whatever, that's exactly the same thing. So it's nothing. Okay, now point C. They claimed to worship Yahweh. They had the name. But northern Israel had already corrupted Yahweh worship before they were exiled. That's why they were exiled. The influx of Gentiles and their pagan gods reduced their understanding even further. Now here's what 2 Kings 17, 29 through 34 says about this. But every nation that came into Israel still made gods of its own. They didn't leave their nation or their culture where they got deported from and come and say, oh, hey, can we worship your God? They brought their gods with them. They brought their foods with them. They brought their clothing with them. They brought their images with them and put them in the shrines of the high places that the Samaritans had made. So they said they made high places for Yahweh, but they brought in Baal practices. Well, now that they've been exiled, the Gentiles come in and say, oh, hey, there's a nice house there. I like this place here. I might set a little business up here. Oh, look, a shrine. And they put their gods in the Israelites' shrines. So now, in a shrine that was supposed to be made falsely for Yahweh, that was overrun with Baal worship, now it's got pagan images in it. So you can see how deluded this is. The men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth. The men of, he just gives you the names of the gods that they brought in. The men of Cuth made Nergal. The men of Hamath made Ashima. And the Avites made Nibhez and Tartak. Now, again, we could look all these up. I'm just giving you a footnote on this. And the Sepharvites burnt their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anammelech. That'd be the abortion centers. The gods of Sepharim. They also feared the Lord and appointed from among themselves all sorts of the people as priests. See, they also feared the Lord. Who? They also feared Yahweh. Oh, hey, there's already a God here. We better worship him too. So they got this God and this God. They're burning their children over here and say, who's this God? This is Yahweh. This is what the temple was originally built for. Oh, we better honor him too. We fear the Lord. Which qualifies them as what we would say, they must be Christians. They also feared the Lord and appointed from among themselves all sorts of people as priests. So now you've got Gentiles who are appointing Gentile pagans to be the priests for Yahweh. So as soon as they get done offering the children in the fire, they could come over and do what kind of ritual are you supposed to do for Yahweh? And now they're the priests for Yahweh. And then you're going to wonder, why wouldn't Zerubbabel and Joshua not let these people help build the temple? It's like, that's kind of closed-minded. And you're going to get that same thing in our culture. Why don't you consider all churches Christian churches? Well, because some churches are flying little rainbow flags, and they're not about Noah's Ark. Some are, I don't need to go down that road, but, you know, we could. And sacrifice them in the shrines of the high place. So they feared the Lord, but also served their own gods after the manner of the nation from among whom they had been carried away. It's not rocket science. They came from there with those gods. They came here with those gods. Now they worship their gods. Yahweh worship was here and polluted, so they continued Yahweh worship in a polluted sense. To this day, they do according to their former manner. To the day that this was written, so that would be probably sometime in here, whenever this is being finalized, they're still doing it. It may be, many scholars say Ezra's closing down Chronicles. He's the one that kind of packaged it all up and put it in some kind of form. Ezra's going to be the one that starts the synagogues. Ezra is going to be the one who began the whole concept of the scribes. And so there's a good chance when he may be the one writing this, it could be as late as 450 that he's, and they're still, when Ezra gets there, they're still doing this. I mean, when did they change? To this day, they do according to the former manner. They do not fear the Lord. Now, they say they do, but they do not because they're still worshiping these other gods. And they do not follow the statutes or rules or the law or the commandments that the Lord commanded the children of Jacob, who he named Israel. Now, they'll take the name Yahweh. They'll burn a little offering to Yahweh, but they have no idea who Yahweh is, so they fear the name, but they don't understand the name. So they fear the name and burn a little offering to him, but they don't fear him because they don't even understand his ways. Okay, that's what's called the people of the land or the enemies. Turning the page 5. Here's that first verse was simply this. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, turn the page 5. Chapter 4, verse 2, they came to Zerubbabel. So the people we just described, they came to Zerubbabel and said, hey, you're building a temple. And to the heads of the families and says, let us help you build because you, like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, the king of Assyria, who brought us here. So they say in 536, right at this time period right there, they say, we have been worshiping Yahweh just like you're going to since the day that we are brought here. Now, if we go back, and I don't have the chart up here, if we go back through Esarhaddon, I got that written down here, go down to point 2. Esarhaddon ruled from 681 to 669. He was very strong in implementing that Assyrian practice of deportation, importation, to keep people off balance, to keep them confused. You keep people weak by combining them and keeping them mixed up, their language, their culture, their religions, and there's no unification. You cannot unify that type of people. And that's the concept, divide and conquer. And that's what the Assyrians did. That's what made them great. He was the son of Sennacherib, Remember Sennacherib? He's the one that Hezekiah dealt with. He's the one who destroyed Lachish and destroyed all the fortified cities of Judah except Jerusalem. He lost 185,000 men, went back to Nineveh, built himself a palace, and lined the halls of his palace with, on gypsum stone, panels of his battle at Lachish, which was his last battle before 185,000 soldiers died, and he had to come back home and totally scared. He was then assassinated by one of his sons, Esarhaddon. His sons came up against him. So son of Sennacherib, and then he is the grandson of Sargon II, who was the final emperor to destroy. He came in 722, right when Samaria was falling. And so, Sargon, Sennacherib, and then Esarhaddon had been deporting people, and they claim to have been there since, 670, 660 B.C. Chapter 4, verse 3. But Zerubbabel, the political leader, he is like the governor, and Joshua, he's the priest, the high priest, the spiritual leader, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, "You have no part with us in building a temple to our God." Now you understand, in a casual reading of this in your morning devotions, it's like, whoa, that's not very Christian sounding. They should have been more tolerant. They should have been more open. If someone wants to get involved in your church, you should let them get involved in your church. Who are you to judge? These people are probably not going to be very favored by God because they said, no, you can't help us build the temple. And then you go on your postmodern world and you think you're righteous and holy and doing the right thing. You have no understanding that they were exactly like America is today, trying to get involved in the church. It's like, no, you can't come in here. You have no part of us. You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us. So they're actually naming two kings. We're going to build it for the king, the Lord, the way he wants it, the way he prescribed it. And you have no idea what he's talking about. You've got too many other gods, and you haven't been worshiping for 200 years. And also, we've been told by Cyrus, the emperor, that we're supposed to build it. He didn't tell us to find people to help us. We've got commands from Yahweh. We've got commands from Cyrus. And with that being said, it wasn't Zerubbabel and Joshua and the heads of the family saying no. It was them telling God's will and the emperor's will, no, you can't help. Say, well, why are they so judgmental? They're just following directions. Yahweh says this. Cyrus says this. We're spiritually and politically, we got to say no. Chapter 4, verse 4. Then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. So you're going to discourage them, which again, right there means you weren't here for the right reason. You're here where you, well, if we can't help, then we're going to discourage you from doing it. And they were afraid to go on building. Point one, set out to discourage does not mean they tried one time or they began, but their efforts faded. This was a campaign of harassment. This was a nonstop cancel culture just coming at you every day, every way, until finally you say, who can be a Christian in this culture? We're just going to give up and accept it. We can't fight it anymore. And again, you can still call it, they're going to be rebuked. They were going to give up around 536 in this time period. They're going to give up and say, we can't even fight this culture. And by 520, the prophets are going to show up and say, you have no excuse. You're following Yahweh. You're following Cyrus the emperor. You've got the law on your side. You've got the God of the universe on your side. And it's too hard for you. We just read those books. Okay, turn the page. And now it gets confusing. Stay with me. It's going to get confusing and not. I mean, this is so fits our culture. I mean, I'm not sure if you're seeing this or if I'm just reading too much into it. Chapter 4, verse 5, they discouraged them and made them afraid. That's what they're doing, terrorizing you, making you afraid in your own town, doing things to discourage you. but also they bribed officials to work against them. They've got boots on the ground trying to terrorize you, but also they're going to be sending money up the food chain of government to make sure they're making laws and putting roadblocks in your way that you can't get it done. Maybe hiring extra IRS agents or something like this, just kind of make it a little more of a hassle. Now, again, you may think about bribing. Bribing probably doesn't happen in our government. Or you can think differently and think maybe the whole government's run on bribery. Or you can find a middle ground. But they bribed the enemies, the people of the land, the Samaritans, bribed the higher-ups in the Persian government to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, right here, king of Persia. Are you ready for this? From Cyrus, king of Persia, all the way down to the reign of Darius. So all the way through Cambyses, all the way down to Darius, until 520, they're going to be discouraging the people. And Darius reigned from 521 to 486, right in this time period. And that's when the prophets show up, and then that's when the temple is finally completed. Now, I've just got written right here on middle of page 6, Haggai chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. I don't have the whole thing written down, they're just the first verse. In the second year of Darius, 520, in the sixth month, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came by the hand of Haggai the prophet to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. These are the ones who said, no, you can't help us build. And now, 16 years later, they haven't done anything. The whole thing came to a halt. The you can't help us build, so they came in opposition, discouraging them, making them afraid, and then bribing the authorities above them. And now for 16 years, they haven't done anything. After 16 years, God says, okay, sends Haggai, and Haggai comes and wakes the people up and says, you say, it's not time to build. Well, look at your houses. Well, you had time to panel your houses. No one's interfering with the trade routes with your paneling. Why can't you build? Well, we're scared. Well, you better be more scared of Yahweh. And that's that chapter. Now, if you have your Bibles open, you may notice this is a rough move right here. And I've got it on the notes here. But if you look right there, and I've got in my Bible, not that that means anything to you, but I've got a big black line right underneath verse 5. And then I have another black line on chapter 4, verse 23, right underneath there. Because between verse 5, or we got it right there, Ezra chapter 4, verse 6 through 24, we're going to throw names at you. It's like, what the heck? Because if you read this in your daily devotions, you're going to read about the opposition. And then in chapter 4, verse 6, it begins to talk about one of the letters of opposition. But we're talking about 536 all the way down until 520 during the reign of Darius. And then all of a sudden, chapter 4, verse 6, and in the reign of Ahasuerus, that's Xerxes. Now, Ahasuerus, that is the guy who married Esther. We get his name out of Esther. That's Xerxes. That's this guy. Okay, Xerxes. And in the reign of Xerxes, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. Now notice where we're at. During Xerxes' reign. Now Xerxes, couple things. As Esther begins with him having a big banquet, having all of his weapons, the planes are flying over and doing little formations, and the ships are sailing by, and there's a parade of all the tanks, and people are waving flags, and all of his emperors or all of his generals are there, and they're getting ready to invade Greece. Now, at this point, you can read history and read about the invasion of Greece and make a movie about, call it 300. You know, the 300, you ever saw that movie, the 300, the Persians? Anyway, that's Xerxes and his people going over there to fight. And that's what's getting ready in Esther chapter 1. Xerxes goes over there, has all kinds of trouble, comes back, realizes that he doesn't have a queen, has to find Esther, and that's where Esther chapter 2 begins after he loses everything. So all the way during this time. But that's 485 to 464. And here's a letter that they're going to write him. The enemies of the land are going to write a letter to Xerxes. Well, when was the temple completed? In 516. So we're in 485. You can see that that's what you do, 15. That's 30 years after the temple's done. They're complaining about something. So this letter has nothing to do with the temple. They opposed them, caused frustration, bribed the officials. The prophets show up, say, get it done. They get it done in a matter of months. The temple is done in 515, 516, and that's up and running. But now, during Xerxes' time, they write this letter. Now, what's going to be taking place now is the temple. This is my point. This letter has nothing to do with this opposition. It has, as far as the temple, it has to do with the opposition that just continues throughout this whole period from the Samaritans. What this letter is against is the people are now starting to build the wall. They're starting to build the foundation and put the walls up. They're finalizing the city. And they're going to write to Xerxes, and we're going to have a letter from Artaxerxes, and they're going to say, they're going to accuse him of, you can go back and check the records, because remember, there's all kinds of records. You know, Esther's uncle, Mordecai. He heard some people talking about a plan to assassinate Xerxes. And one night, they wrote it down, and Xerxes was having his chronicles read to him because he couldn't go to sleep, and they ran across Mordecai's name. He says, did we ever give that guy an award? He goes, no, he never got a reward. There's no record of it. He said, well, we're going to have to, and that's what, so he's reading they had all kinds of records, cuneiform tablets. See? They had all these records that they would write in different forms. And so they're going to go back, they're going to be told, go back and check the records, and you're going to find out that this Jerusalem has been a problem throughout the ages. They had trouble with Sennacherib, they had trouble with Nebuchadnezzar, they had trouble throughout the ages. They're a rebellious city, and they're starting to build their walls. It's like, so they check their records, like, oh my gosh, they are an evil people, they are in revolt. No, you can't build the wall. So here we go, chapter 4, verse 6. Now, the point, why is he putting this in here? Ezra is capturing the opposition of what's going on this whole time period until he arrives here in 458. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, in the beginning of his reign, that's just what the Bible just says, that they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. And what he means, they, the enemies, the same ones who opposed back here in 536, that lost out in 520 because of the prophets, are back on accusing him of something else. And so you got a huge time gap as far as the story goes. Against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem, chapter 4, verse 7, in the days of Artaxerxes, see now right there, see that? In the days of Artaxerxes, now we moved over to here. Now here's some names of some people. I want to go through this maybe later. Bishlam and Mithridath and Tabeel and the rest of their associates wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia. The letter was written in Aramaic and translated. So now you can see right there, chapter 4, verse 6, they wrote an accusation during Xerxes' reign. We don't have that letter. In the days of Artaxerxes, they write another letter trying to keep opposition. And it gives you the names of the people that were there and who wrote the letter. These leaders would probably be governors or appointees. This is called, this side over here, this side of the Euphrates is called the Trans-Euphrates. It would include Syria, Phoenicia, Israel, maybe some other lands up north. That's Trans-Euphrates. That's the land on the other side. It means the land on the other side of the river. Mesopotamia means the land between the rivers. So when you're over in Babylon or Susa or Ecbatana or Persepolis, the Trans-Euphrates, that means the land on the other side of the river. So that was conquered by the Persians, and they probably put governors in place, just like Nebuchadnezzar put Gedaliah, a Jew, in charge of Jerusalem. They may have taken local people and put them in charge, and they had Persian recognition. And so these people of Trans-Euphrates are going to write in Aramaic, which is the language that was spoken when they came back out of Babylon. But it's not going to be able to be read and understood by the Persian king, Artaxerxes. So it's going to have to be translated. So they write a letter to Artaxerxes. The letter was written in Aramaic and had to be translated into some kind of cuneiform script. Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, the scribe, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes, the king, as follows. Rehum, the commander, gives all the names of the people. Rehum, the commander, so you got a whole, this is who's writing the letter. Look at this. How would you like to have a letter sent to your boss signed by another employee complaining about you? That would be bad. How would you like a letter sent to your boss complaining about you signed by everybody on the staff, all of the surrounding local businesses that you are working with, and everybody signs the letter? Well, that's what they've got right here. Rehum the commander, Shimshai the scribe, and the rest of their associates, the judges, the governors, the officials, the Persians, the men of Erech, the Babylonians, the men of Susa, that is the Elamites, and the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Ashnapar deported, and that would be Ashnapar, that was Ashurbanipal. That's one of the Persian kings, excuse me, Assyrian kings that deported, that's going back to 720, deported and settled in the cities of Samaria and the rest of the province beyond the river, and in Trans-Euphrates. Those are all the people. So that means everybody who was deported into this land by the Assyrians. Now this is the Persians. They defeated the Babylonians, who defeated the Persians. These people are the people, they defeated the Assyrians. These are the people the Assyrians moved into the land, and all their judges and all the lands in Trans-Euphrates, everybody, are writing now to Artaxerxes, and they're complaining about the Jews back in Jerusalem. So, I mean, this has got, I mean, the court system is against you. The tax system is against you. The media is against you. Everybody in the surrounding countries, in Canada and Mexico, is against you. And we got to complain. In chapter 4, verse 11, it says in the text, this is a copy of the letter that they sent. They wrote, to Artaxerxes the king, your servants, the men of the province beyond the river, Trans-Euphrates, everybody on the other side of the Euphrates, send greetings. And now, be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from you to us have gone to Jerusalem. They came up from Persia by Cyrus. They're admitting that. They've gone to Jerusalem. They are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. Notice they're not rebuilding the temple. The temple's already done. They're going further. They're building that rebellious and wicked city. They are finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. Now notice this. This is Artaxerxes. He's got a cupbearer, or eventually have a cupbearer that brings his wine to him, named Nehemiah. And Nehemiah, one day, Artaxerxes is getting this letter. And they're saying they're building the walls. They're laying the foundations and building the walls up. And Artaxerxes is going to say, yeah, that don't sound good. Yeah, they can't do that. And one day Nehemiah brings his wine in, and he says, well, you look sad. What's wrong? He says, my city lays in ruins. And basically he's telling him, because you said they couldn't build the walls. He doesn't say it like that, but that's what's happening. And he says, you know, well, what's your plan? He says, well, he says, how much time do you need? I'll be gone for, 2 years. He says, well, here you go. There's everything you need. And signs the paper that he can use all the lumber and timber out of all, everything on Trans-Euphrates, it's all yours. So Nehemiah rolls into town with a letter from Artaxerxes, who's getting the letter from Trans-Euphrates saying, don't do it. He says, oh, yeah, they shouldn't do it. Nehemiah says, I really like to do it. Sure. And he shows up. It's a miracle. I mean, it's crazy time right here. It's like history is like swinging like from here to here. It's like woke, and then all of a sudden, boom, no, we're not. It's like, how'd that happen? The hand of God. Now, just interesting, right, do I have, yes, right here. See this right here? That's a picture from the British Museum. There's a whole set of, those are silver bowls, about like this, shallow bowls like this. They're wine bowls. And in cuneiform writing all the way around the side, there's no doubt about this. It is the great king, the son of Xerxes, Artaxerxes, the great king who rules the world, or something to that effect. You can look it up. They're silver bowls. They're wine bowls. They pour the wine in them so they'd sit out and get oxygen and stuff. And I don't know if there's four or six, something in there that you can see. I just got the picture of one of them. But it's got, and it's a wine bowl. And Artaxerxes would have drank wine out of that bowl, and Nehemiah was his, carried the wine to him. So this could, again, hypothetically, this could have been the bowl that he was walking in with and sat down, and the king says, "You look sad, what's wrong?" And you know the whole story about Nehemiah, we'll eventually get there. Isn't that amazing? But hey, my wife is at the door, which means class is over. She's ready to go eat. Boy, you see kind of what's happening here. We got to clean this up next week, but it's kind of fun, I think, when you see all these things, because if you read through there, it gets real confusing, potentially. And if I explain it to you, it becomes like just a jumbled mess. It's like, so anyway, we'll clean that up next week, because at some point it's going to break and go right back. We're going to talk about this, and all of a sudden, boom, we're back here talking about a letter that they wrote. It's like, and if you don't read it carefully, if you don't have a chart, if I don't have a chart like this, I'm like, if you notice, it's like, oh, you really understand this. I keep looking back at the chart, Okay, I'll pray and we're ready to go. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We ask that we would, again, judge our own hearts, that we would draw near to you, that we would not allow foreign intervention of foreign gods and foreign false philosophies influence our thinking, but we would have our minds renewed to your word, that we would continue to walk in your ways and become the people you've called us to be and be a light at this time to our nation, to our families, to the people around us. We do ask that we would walk in your ways in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you for your time.